Tonight we're looking at the very final chapter in the book of Jonah. Kenny kicked us off about 3 weeks ago, and then Nikki helped us a little bit further along the way 2 weeks ago, and then last week it was David, and we're looking at chapter 3 today. We're looking at chapter 4, no surprises there. But a question to think about for all, us all, really, it's quite an important question. Why was the book of Jonah ever written? I mean, why was it written? Because it's quite a strange story. It's all about a man who runs away, and then he comes back again, and he does what God wants, and as we'll see today, he ends up in a very, very bad mood. I mean, what's it all about? The story itself, we're going to look at it from two different angles. We're going to look at it firstly from Jonah's angle, and then we're going to look at it from God's angle. If you've got the red Bibles in your hands, we're on page number 928. But I'll have the words up on the screen so we can all read it, or we can all look at it together. I don't know if you remember last week, an amazing thing happened in the book of Jonah. There was this city, this pagan city, this city of complete wicked, nasty people, 120,000 of them, which is about the size of Dundee, maybe? Yeah, about that size. Imagine the size of the city of Dundee, and just one line that God asks Jonah to say. It's there in chapter 3. Go and tell them 40 more days and Nineveh will be overturned. So he does that. And he takes him 3 days, and it's like just the one sentence, the word from God that starts a landslide. And a bit like, you know, there's a parable Jesus tells of yeast, that tiny bit of yeast that you knead it into the bread and the whole bread gets affected by it. Well, the whole city of Nineveh, 120,000 people, size of Dundee, is affected by this one line that Jonah the prophet says, reluctantly, because God tells him to. It's like God takes charge of that word, that one line, and it cascades throughout the city. And eventually the king hears about it, and everybody repents. Everybody returns from their wicked ways. It's absolutely miraculous. Imagine something like that happening in Dundee today. I've got nothing against Dundee, by the way. My wife's from Perth, so she might have things to say about Dundee. But I personally, I've got nothing against Dundee. But, you know, so imagine something that size. Imagine something like that happening in Edinburgh. It's awesome. And yet, Jonah's reaction is not to be wowed by this at all. I think there's another, there's a real parallel between the story of Jonah and a story that Jesus once told. And I'll just leave that thought with you, because maybe you can think what that story is. It's a well-known story that Jesus told. And there's real parallels with the story of Jonah. Anyway, what was Jonah's reaction? Was it relief? Was it miraculous joy? Was it just awe and wonder at the fact that God is so brilliant? Let's see what happens. Let's look at the first five verses, and let's see if this doofer is going to work. Yay, it is. Okay, so this is the end of chapter 3 we begin with, verse 10. When God saw what the Ninevites did and how they turned from their evil ways, he relented and did not bring on them the destruction he had threatened. Wow. But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. He prayed to the Lord, "Isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home?" That is back in Judea. This is what I tried to stop happening by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. In other words, I knew you were going to do this. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it's better for me to die than to live. But the Lord replied, "Is it right for you to be angry?" Jonah had gone out and sat down in a place east of the city, and there he made himself a shelter, sat in its shade, and waited to see what would happen to the city. Okay. So, what do we learn from this? We learn that apparently the reason Jonah had run away in the first place was not because he was afraid of going to Nineveh. And it was not because he thought that God was asking him to do something impossible, that he was going to put him in extreme danger, and that, you know, somehow he'd be hurt by it, or, you know, his life would be threatened by it. It was none of that. The reason Jonah ran away was because he knew what God would be like when he got there. He knew that God was gracious and compassionate and full of mercy and abounding in love, all those things that he quotes here in this verse. Gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. And he knew that if God was like that, and the Ninevites listened and repented, that God was going to let them off. That's why he didn't want to go. He knew what God was like. And how did he know what God was like? Well, because he was an Israelite. And unlike the people at Nineveh, the Israelites had a revealed scriptural knowledge of God. And as David said at the very beginning, if you read through the scriptures of the Old Testament again and again and again and again and again, you find God describing himself to people like Moses and to many, many people after Moses as someone who's gracious and merciful and slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. And Jonah was a prophet, so of all the Israelites, he would have known this better than most. And he knew that if he went to Nineveh, and if they changed their ways, then God would relent. He had known it all along. Now, can you see the irony here? I mean, there's a double irony. First, the final chapter is at the moment when God stops being angry, Jonah starts getting angry. So there's an irony to start with. And then, remember, God had shown Jonah mercy and compassion. And where's Jonah's mercy and compassion towards the Ninevites? So there's a second irony there. And when you begin to see this, you begin to find the answer to the question, what is this book about? And actually, just to warn you, it gets very near to the bone. And I find this a very challenging book. And you might well find it quite challenging towards the end of tonight as well. Basically, Jonah ends up saying, if this is what's going to happen, God, I'd rather be dead. And you see there in verse 4, God sort of tries to coax him out of his mood. Is it right for you to be angry? But Jonah refuses to budge. He's obstinate, he's resentful, he's stomping out into the hills like a spoilt child. He sits down in the dust to watch and wait. Like nothing God could ever do now is ever going to lift his mood. He's sitting there, he's totally grumpy. I don't know if you've ever done that. I mean, I don't want you to tell me, but it's just a thought to plant there. Have you ever just stomped off? And worse still, have you ever just stomped off from God? Say, okay, I've had it, God. This is it. Well, that's what Jonah's doing. So what do we make of all of this? Well, to understand it a bit better, we need to get under Jonah's skin. See, Jonah was an Israelite, and the Israelites were God's chosen people. The Israelites thought they were God's favorites. And this was a truth that they'd always clung on to. It's a truth that had given the strength to get through the desert to the promised land. It was a truth that had helped them hold out against all the enemies that had come to attack them. It was a truth that throughout their history, whatever they had to face, this one truth had set them apart and given them hope. And it was the truth that unlike all the other gods, all the gods of surrounding nations, all the idols they worshipped, their God, they knew from experience, was gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. All the other gods were nasty, fearful, you never knew what they were going to do type gods. They were vengeful gods. They took pleasure in making people suffer type gods. They demanded fear. They were those type of gods. Those are the gods all the other nations worship. They didn't worship that God. They knew that their God was a nice God. And what's more, they were his chosen people. They were his favorites. That's what kept them going. Of course, anyone who thinks they're a favorite sometimes gets a bit jealous. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. Maybe I should come out the front where you can see me. You know, if you've got a, if you think you're your mum and dad's favourite, and then they start being nice to someone else in your family, you get a bit jealous. My own wee granddaughter Holly is now nearly four. And of course, when you're an only child, you're the centre of your parents' world. And then her wee sister Abby comes along. Lindsay caught her doing something really interesting yesterday. Abby loves dolls. Sorry? Holly never bothered with dolls. That's right, never bothered with dolls. Someone gave Holly this doll for a present. Yeah, I want to play football. That's Holly, by the way. He's a great footballer. Watch this space. Play for Scotland. I'm just biased, I know. Wait, the doll disappeared. Abby's looking for the doll. Where's the doll, Holly? I don't know. Holly had hidden the doll under a cushion. She never played with it herself. That's the trouble when you think you're someone's favorite. There's a tendency you might get a bit jealous. I mean, the one thing you hate is someone else getting in on the act. And here's the Israelites. For centuries, generations, they had thought they were God's favorites. And now here's these Ninevites. And they think they're getting in on the act here. And it's okay when they're wicked through and through and they do horrible things. But now they're saying they've changed. And they've already got all that wealth and all that power. And now they want to have our God too? No way. It's not fair. No way. So that's what's going on inside Jonah's head. That's why he's in such a bad mood. And remember I said at the beginning, there's a parallel between the story of Jonah and a story that Jesus told. Has anybody worked out what that story is? Susan? The prodigal son. Remember? Father has two sons. One son is a sneaky git, very self-centered, goes off, blows it all. The other son's very nice, very good, very dutiful. Thinks he's his dad's favorite because he's such a nice guy. He's really nice. And then when his father tries to show forgiveness and love to his younger brother, who is it that's blazing mad? It's the older brother. Ah, it's not fair. But the real problem is not unfairness. It's the fact that God is being even-handed. Underneath, they're jealous. Both of them, Jonah and the elder brother, they're jealous of their father's love. They don't want to share it. Now, I wonder if what I'm saying strikes any chords with you. Because I have to confess, it does strike some chords with me. I mean, you know, the Bible tells us that God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Whoever believes in him. And that's fine and well, as long as it doesn't apply to so-and-so. I think we've all got so-and-sos in our lives. We've all got Ninevites in our lives. We know from chapter 3 that the Ninevites had been an evil people with wicked and violent ways. I mean, who are the Ninevites in our lives? I mean, on a really big scale, the Ninevites are the so-called Islamic State. You know, imagine if you're living in one of those villages in northern Iraq that has been completely wiped out by the so-called Islamic State. And then you hear that God's going to wipe them out. And then you hear that they've turned from their ways and God's going to let them off. That's not fair. That's what's going on here. Or it may be on a very personal level. There's someone who just makes your life miserable. Someone who every time you remember them or think of them or hear their name, you get that feeling inside. You don't want them to be forgiven. You don't want them to be part of your church family. You know, you want them to be something, a millstone tied around their neck and thrown into the depths of the sea. We've all got Ninevites in our lives. So that's how Jonah's feeling that day. The Ninevites were Israel's sworn enemies. How could God love them? How could he do that? So, it's like he says, I can take so much of this grace and compassion stuff, but you just crossed the line here, God. I'm off. And, of course, The greatest irony in the story is it's not God's grace that Jonah's resenting, it's the fact he's being even-handed. He doesn't seem to mind God giving him a second chance, but he really minds God giving those Ninevites a second chance. So there he is. He's a very grumpy old man. He's waiting to see what's going to happen. And I think the reason he's sitting there waiting to see what's going to happen is in the back of his mind, he's thinking, yeah, they say they've changed, but maybe they haven't. And if I sit here long enough, then I'll see God will know them as they really are, and I'll get to see it happen. You know, I think that's what's going on here. He doesn't want to miss this when it happens. So now the angle's going to shift a bit. That was Jonah's perspective. Right, I'm back down here, so we can see the next part in the story. Here it goes. Then the Lord provided a leafy plant. You can actually see the leafy plant in that picture. A leafy plant, and made it grow up over Jonah to give shade for his head to ease his discomfort. But Jonah was very, very happy about the plant. He thought, oh, that's nice. Bit of shade. Very nice. Thank you. But at dawn the next day, God provided a worm, which chewed the plant so that it withered. See, God's got this real sense of humor here, hasn't it? He thinks he's enjoying the shade. I'm going to provide a worm. When the sun rose, God provided a scorching east wind, and the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. He wanted to die and said, it'd be better for me to die than to live. And I can almost imagine God smiling in verse 9. God said to Jonah, is it right for you to be angry about the plant? It is, he says. I'm so angry, I wish I were dead. Ah! Yeah, I get the feeling here that God's like the loving father trying to deal with a spoilt child. There's Jonah. He's sitting there in the dust. He's hot and fed up. He's waiting for God to change his mind once again and smite these Ninevites. So God thinks, I'm going to have fun here. And he causes this vine to grow up. And we're told it makes Jonah very, very happy. And then God sends a wee worm. And it eats the root of the vine and it withers. And then Jonah is even more fed up than before. And again, God asks him the same question as he did before. Remember at the beginning he says, is it right for you to be angry? Here he says, is it right for you to be angry about the plant? And again, notice the irony. Jonah's angry at God for allowing 120,000 people to live. And now he's angry at God because God has put to death a plant. There's sort of imbalance there. It's almost like a caricature. And this brings us to the point of the whole story, which is summed up by God in his final words. But the Lord said, you have been concerned about this plant, though you did not tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and it died overnight. Should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh? And I put these in giant letters because you see, Jonah and the Israelites had something that the Ninevites did not have. The Ninevites are at a disadvantage here. Should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their left hand from their right? The Ninevites hadn't been given the Ten Commandments. They hadn't been God's chosen people. They hadn't been shown that God loves them. They're just living off scraps. And Jonah's wanting to condemn them all to death despite all that. Jonah hates the Ninevites because they're a threat to his people. And they were a threat to his people. A bit like ISIL. You know, they're that sort of a threat. He's very jealous of God's love for them. He doesn't mind his God being gracious and merciful as long as he's only gracious and merciful to him. God, on the other hand, is even-handed with his grace and mercy. He loves the Ninevites just as much as he loves Jonah. He loves us just as much as he loves our enemies. He loves our enemies just as much as he loves us. He loves the people. He loves the cattle as well. Do you hear that, Ashley? He loves the whole of creation. He made it. He loves it. And the final verses of the story actually make the point very well, because it shows how God's love extends to Jonah himself. I mean, Jonah, really, after what he's just been, do you think he deserved God's love and mercy? I mean, honestly. But the way God deals with this thrawn, self-centered, grumpy old man is proof that he is gracious and merciful. I mean, it's nice being gracious and merciful to nice people. It's even good being gracious and merciful to people who've repented and turned away and trying to do, you know. Jonah's doing none of those things. And there's God still being great, providing him with a plan, trying to get him to think outside the box. He's just coaxing him along, gently, patiently. Wee Abby, the one who loves dolls, she's just 19 months, 18 months. She has discovered tantrums big time. Hands up if you've ever had a tantrum. Hands up if you can remember. You know what a tantrum is. You want something, doesn't matter how unreasonable it is. You don't get it. You can see Abby doing it. Abby asks for something. You say, no, Abby, you can't have that right now. Like she wants to put her finger in the electrical sockets, you know, and switch it on. No, Abby, you can't do that, darling. So you can see the look coming in her face. And she deliberately throws herself on the ground, starts kicking and screaming and shouting, just doing all that stuff. And all the time, you know, as I watch her do this, I love her buckets. I'm like, oh, Abby, that's such a good tantrum. I love you for that tantrum. That's what God's doing to Jonah. That's what God's doing here to Jonah. He's, oh, Jonah, I love your tantrum. You're taking grumpiness to a higher form of art. That is amazing, Jonah. But he still loves him. He still loves him. And remember that story of the prodigal son, where it's the elder brother. The younger brother drags himself home, and he's sorry. He knows he's never going to be loved again. But he gets the shock of his life because his dad has always loved him. And he welcomes him home, and he gets him cleaned up and gives him some fresh clothes. And, let's have a party. My son was lost. And the elder brother's going, you never loved me as much as you loved him. You know, he's doing all this act. And the father goes out to the elder brother and begs him, come on, I've always loved you. You're missing out on the fun. This is your brother. Come and join it. So it's like the elder brother is lost. He's chained by his resentment. He's trapped by his hatred. He's just dragged down and poisoned by all his jealousy and stuff. That's what's wrong with Jonah. God's trying to save him. And the interesting thing about both the story of Jonah and the story of the two sons is both stories are left hanging. You don't know. You don't know whether Jonah's going to, oh, you know, you're right. What an idiot I am. Let's go and join the party. You know, you don't know whether he's going to do that. He's just going to stay here. I'd rather die. And it's the same with the elder brother. You don't know whether he's going to go in or whether he's going to stay out, lost and lonely. You don't know. And it challenges us to put ourselves in that story. What would we do? And what are we going to do now? Like I said earlier, we've all got our Ninevites. We've all got those people who we'd much rather just face the judgment of God and not his grace and mercy. And yet, when we think that way, we're like the elder brother. You know, we're trapped, we're poisoned, we're embittered, we're missing out on God's grace. So it's like we've all got this choice, and it doesn't matter how long we've been Christians. You know, things happen, but people hurt us, sometimes deliberately, sometimes not deliberately, and every time that happens, we've got a choice. It's sometimes said that the I don't know what happened there, but it was deliberate. It's sometimes said that the whole Christian value system is summed up by the saying, love your neighbor as yourself, you know? But actually, I don't agree with that. Because you go to most world religions and you'll find they'll say something similar. It's called the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself. I think that our faith in Jesus is summed up by Jesus' own words, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. I think that is the saying that sums up our faith. And so at any time in our life, we are always confronted with that. Every time we say that Lord's Prayer, we're confronted with that choice. Is there anyone we're not forgiving? Is there anyone we're not forgiving? And it's not as if God's saying, oh, well, I'm not going to forgive you then. It's that our unforgiveness traps us, like it's trapped Jonah, and it's trapped the elder brother. It chains us. It drains the joy out of our lives. We are prisoners of that. And the choice that we're given is to ask God for the strength to offer them the forgiveness that he's offered us. So let's just spend a few moments now. I'm going to, if you could just play some music very quietly, Ek. I want you just to have a wee conversation with God, because you need to ask yourselves, as I will ask myself, who is it in my life that I don't want God to love as much as he loves me? Is there anyone in my life, maybe a hurt from the past, maybe a hurt that's ongoing, maybe a group of people that we've been scarred by in the past, and we just cannot see them ever changing, and we want them to suffer for it? A bit like Jonah and the Ninevites, a bit like the elder and younger brother. Once you've identified who that person or those people are, I want you to have a conversation with God about them and ask for his help so that you can be set free of the unforgiveness that chains you. And now, if you're able, join me and let's say the words of the Lord's Prayer together. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive those our debtors. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever.